Hey everybody, it's Jughead, and I'm going to make this a quick one. I just want to thank one of my new patrons. His name is Dan Harrison, and he came in at the $2 tier for donations, but he paid for the full year, so he paid $20.40. So thank you, Dan. You too can become a patron at the $2, $5, or $10 tiers. Just go to my website, www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com, and on the right there should be a link to Patreon. You can go there and it'll whiz you to that new location where you can sign up and donate to the show. You have an option where you could pay monthly, or you can actually pay 1 year at a time, which would be great. With these, you get differing ranges of material, like unedited videos of all of the interviews that are done. You also get blog posts and me writing for my new book called We Screeched, which is about all the bands I was in, short stories, and photos. Don't know when that'll be out yet, but stay tuned. So do that. If you can't, I understand. We really do need your help in some form or another. You can go and share it with people, or animals, or triggers, or trigger warnings, or slings and arrows. This was a really fun interview. I was actually a bit nervous talking to this younger fellow of the punk world, so it was very exciting to get to know him. Let's do it. You're listening to Pub Feed by The Chats off their 2020 record, High Risk Behavior. Hello everybody and welcome to Jughead's Basement, episode 169 with Eamon Sandwith of The Chats, lo-fi interviews with hi-fi guests. On this episode, we talked to Eamon about the future of signing autographs, mates and early gigs with the unknowns, cheap equipment and jerry-rigging your gear, Dave Grohl becomes a fan, interviews and on what people expect you to become, the effect of smoko and maintaining integrity by not thinking too much about it, plus much, much smoko, furfy, bloke, bludger, bogan, drongos, more.
Chicken schnitty.
Hey, how you going?
Hey, Eamon, you are very punctual.
I'm on time.
Exactly on time.
Were you expecting me to be late? Is everyone usually late?
No, actually, some people are usually a bit early because they don't know how the system works.
Okay. I'm down with the system.
You're down with the system. I think you're one of those younger generation people. You kind of know the internet, the web machine.
Yeah, we figured it out.
Did you even have, in my age, we used to have actual, like in school, we had to take typewriter, like with an actual typewriter lessons. You know, you sat in a class and everyone, like 50 people, you hear going.
Yeah, no, we never had typewriters. No. I remember doing handwriting lessons. I don't even know if they do handwriting anymore.
Yeah, I'm wondering about that. You know, now as you know, as we actually face that we have audiences that like us, like fans, I think they call them. They actually need autographs. What are we going to do in the future? Are people just going to like iPad?
I've already thought of that. I'm going to get a stamp.
I'm in Japan now, and they actually have a thing called hanko, which is everyone in Japan has to have a stamp with their name on it.
Oh, cool.
For the well, here's the thing that I think is strange. They need it for government documents, but you can buy them at the corner like konbini stores.
Okay, right.
How is it's like buying a button that says like I went to Disneyland. My name is Bob or something, but the government actually accepts it as a stamp.
Relatively speaking, be pretty easy to like steal an identity in
I know you
Japan.
actually even have a song about that, I guess.
Yeah.
Have you had experience with that?
No, it's just a rubbish, just total bullshit. Yeah, no, I wish I'd known that. I could have worked something about Japan in there.
Yeah, I think I heard in our earlier interview, I think Matt had said that they wanted to, you guys wanted to, or he wanted at least wanted to tour Japan. Have you done that since then? I think that was an earlier interview.
No, he actually went on a trip on his own this year, like a couple months ago.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, we had a couple months off, and he was like, oh, I'm going to go to Japan for about a month.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah, I've been here for on and off for the last 9 years.
In Tokyo?
I'm in Osaka, which is more of a blue collar sort of town. So,
Okay, right, cool. I've never been. I'd like to go someday.
yeah. Well, I know the territory now. So if Matt wants to come back again, I can teach him a few things.
Cool, I'll send him your way.
Does he like to hike?
He loves hiking, actually. Yeah, it's
Oh,
the
that's one of my
yeah.
favorite pastimes. That's what I mostly do here to stay sane.
Yeah, all right. Well, I'll have to link you guys up. Go on a big hike.
I don't know if you know the show, but I've already started. This is sort of my approach to trying to get a conversational interview going.
Yeah, cool.
Thank you for doing this.
No, thanks for having me.
I think you're I do you call him manager, Matt? Is manager Matt? Do you call him
Yeah,
manager Matt?
we all he makes us all call him that. It's yeah, it's his thing.
Is he's with the I saw did some studying and I actually just asked him about this, but he also does the Cosmic Psychos. Is that your connection?
Yeah, that's how we met him. Yeah, he did the doco too, documentary.
Did you use like go see the Cosmic Psychos when you were like younger than you are younger now?
Never really had the chance to when I was younger. I definitely like it was a band that I definitely liked. Like growing up as a teenager, getting into music and stuff. Yeah, just never really got the chance to. It's quite hard, like seeing bands in Australia, if you're under 18. Like I know from touring the States, a lot of the shows are like 14 and up or whatever. But here it's mostly due to liquor laws, mainly it's just mostly 18 plus shows. The band will have to like do like an all ages show and then an 18 plus one at night usually.
Yeah, well, we were the same way with Screeching Weasel back in like in the 80s. We were in the suburbs, but we could play some like garages there. But once we went into the city, we had to play over 21 clubs. So
Yeah, right.
yeah, it wasn't much different. We were playing with bands like Naked Ray Gun, who were like the kings of Chicago at that time.
Sick, sick.
Yeah. So it was a similar thing. You also have to deal with like a lot of my audience is in America, some in Europe, but I'm trying to garner some more of an Australian audience because I've always been a fan of Australian music. But touring is fucking difficult in Australia. You in a van and like miles and miles and miles of like nothing.
Well, that's the thing, like most bands, like you got to fly really, because it's just doesn't work out to sit in a van for like 12 hours a day unless you're waking up at like 3 a.m. or whatever.
Did you guys attempt that at all in your like earlier days before you had a viral video?
No, I mean, we really didn't play outside of Sunshine Coast, well, let's say we didn't play outside of Southeast Queensland until after that video. Like we had plans, like we wanted to do it, but it just didn't work out. We just didn't have the fans there.
Yeah,
Like
I didn't have the momentum.
at the time of that video kind of going viral or whatever, we probably had like 100 likes on our Facebook page, and that's just like our friends and family that we're like hassling to like it. So that was really like a bit of a lucky thing for us. So that kind of opened a lot of doors.
Hello, John in the future here, and this will be mentioned a little bit later in the podcast, but I thought I should say here to give a little context. The Chats self-released a song on their YouTube called Smoko in October of 2017, and as of this recording right now, it has 18,677,484 views. Back to Eamon.
At that time, did you just do like the old school of like just playing each other's basements and garages and things like that?
Yeah. We formed in high school, so we couldn't really play a lot of venues because, well, where we were from, Sunshine Coast wasn't, I don't really know what it's like now because I've moved away, but it wasn't really, there wasn't really much of a scene for, you know, like rock and roll bands, what we were doing. It was a lot more like indie kind of rock sort of stuff. There was really only one other band that we played with on the coast, like The Unknowns, who are still good mates of ours.
The Unknowns are another Sunshine Coast, Australia band formed in 2014. Eamon has done a few recordings with this band, and their guitarist, Josh Hardy, replaced Josh Pricey Price in the Chats on guitar in 2020.
Yeah, it was just like, yeah, we just put on parties and played backyards and did that as much as we could. We drive down to Brisbane and, you know, do the same thing. We'd play at like a footy club or someone's backyard or something. So it was a real like community way of doing it in those early days, which was a lot of fun, but it was hard to do that. It's hard to do it after a couple of years or so, especially because all of these parties we were playing, it was like our mates' parties and we were like begging them to let us play, and we were like, come on, we'll bring all the gear and everything, it'll be fine. And then we play and everyone would be like, these guys are shit, like no one wanted us to play.
I had a few like punk band friends that would always ask to play like each other's weddings, and to me that was like an accident waiting to happen, you know. Like a punk band at a wedding. The only one I've ever seen work was Teenage Bottle Rocket did a wedding a few years ago in Chicago, and it like the 70-year-olds, the 20-year-olds, they were all dancing. It was the most bizarre thing
cool.
I've ever seen.
Were they doing like covers of their own songs?
No, they did their own thing. And they said, yeah, I don't know if you do know Teenage Bottle Rocket, those guys at all?
Yeah, not personally.
Yeah, Cody's a really good friend of mine. I put out Lillington's records earlier than that, but they invited me to this thing, and we were all thinking it was going to be like some accident, like I said, accident waiting to happen, because all our experiences when like a groom and, you know, bride ask you to play a punk band at a show, usually it's a disaster, but everyone got into it. It was really great. It was
cool.
It changed my mind about being a wedding band.
Yeah. Well, I remember my guitar teacher in school telling me that there was a lot more money in that and I should just do that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm not a good enough musician. Do you feel like you're good enough to actually pull off like learning those songs, like learning all the Beatles catalog and
Journey? No, probably not.
I was thinking about that when I saw one of your interviews, because your drummer Matt dropped that in the early days. One of you, I think you were playing out of like a keyboard amp or something.
Yeah, I didn't have a bass amp for a long time.
Yeah, because that reminded me, because when I started Screeching Weasel, I used a DJ amp because I used to be a DJ. So it wasn't even a guitar amp. Why everyone used to describe my sound as crinkling paper as a guitar sound. And I always took that as like a compliment. But when I heard that, I was like, oh, that's pretty exciting. Like, you guys really just, why a keyboard amp? Mine, I got mine because my friends bought me a car as a joke. It was a piece of junk. And my brother wanted it, so he traded to me for a DJ amp, like this 1960s old DJ amp. So
that's cool.
When I started a band, I just used that. But how did you end up with a keyboard amp?
We used to practice at our mate's shed. Shout out to Tristan. We used to practice in his shed, and I believe he had a few things there. And I remember now, it's because he had one of those electronic drum kits, you know, like with the
Oh,
soft pads on them. So you have one of those, and he'd plug it into his keyboard amp to get some sound out of it, I suppose. And I think, in our brains we were like, oh, that's good enough, that'll do for a bass amp. So we were never like, we're never really like gearheads or anything. We always just played through like whatever the other bands could bring. We never really had like good stuff until we like started touring properly, I think.
I want to get to that, like that sort of change for you. But now that you mentioned it, did that change your playing at all? Does it feel different, or are you just as good on whatever junk you find? I had wondered that. I'm asking you because I wondered that myself. I had this Westone that was $100. Then I got these SGs, and I really didn't, I got it because of Angus Young, but I didn't really tell the difference. I mean, for me, for what I was doing.
I picked up one of my earlier basses, like one of my first ones that I bought for like $100 or whatever. They were like, because I was back at my mum's place a couple of weeks back, and I was playing that, and I was like, oh, I don't know how I ever played this. Like, it just feels kind of clunky. And I think it's just like, because when you play like a good bass for a bit, you go back to it, you're like, oh, this is crap. But when you're a kid, you got no idea what like a good guitar or a good bass feels like. So you make do, I guess. It's like, it's not even an option to like use something better.
So do you like the sounds that you got out of that? Like if you compare your old record to new, is
Nah, I'll tell you the truth, I don't really like the sounds on the first two EPs. It's like, I like the songs on yeah, look, it's like, it's hard because it's, it's always like slower than you remember, and you sound like a lot more juvenile or, nasally or whatever. And but I guess other people like it, so whatever.
yeah. Once you start playing out that you start, drummers naturally start speeding up
Oh yeah.
unless you're like Wire and that drummer has actually has the metronome thing going on in his ear. So they always stay the
Yeah.
same. But I realized that too. Once time we did a couple records with Screeching Weasel. I think it was Television City Dream. We purposely went in doing it way past our own abilities of speed because we knew that if we ever played live again that it would seem too slow, so
A lot of those early Weasel recordings are like fast as, like lightning fast.
we were pretty fast in our day, I guess, but we were influenced by this band called Adrenaline OD. I don't know if you're them, but they're out of New Jersey, but they were like in godly fast, crazy. That actually reminds me too, because I was like, I don't even, Eamon, I don't really like going into people's influences, but you do have this, you hit a little bit of this retro market that probably helps you a bit. Like you might have clicked into something that was going on that brought that stuff back. Because I've been feeling it like a lot of my older musician friends, because of the pandemic or whatever, have been actually revived their careers and going back to like Keith Moore is from Off, like doing like super fast hardcore stuff. It seems like you might have clicked into that. And did you feel like you were actually bringing back an old style, or were you just doing whatever the hell you guys wanted to do, or what was your awareness of that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think we were really consciously trying to bring anything back. I think that was just what we like to listen to, or what I like to listen to, I should say. But yeah, it was when I was like maybe like 12, or it would have been earlier, I would have been like 10. I got the Dookie CD, and that was like my punk, like, what is this? And I kind of like went backwards from there. So like all through my teen years, it was like, like early Misfits and, all the classics like that, the Ramones. And but then like you get more into like Australian stuff like Cosmic Psychos and Hard-Ons.
Something about you, I can see it in your eyes. And every time you walk by me,
so I think it just came from a lot of the stuff that we liked and just what we wanted to hear, I guess.
yeah, I'm gonna drop this to you because I think whether you if you don't know it, you should get it because it's one of the ones that changed me a little bit about how I think about punk. But there's a double album that came out in the 80s called Burning Ambitions. Have you ever heard of that? History of Punk.
Nah.
Oh, it's great. I'm actually going to send you the link on the Zoom maybe sometime, but A lot of it has like the early fall on there. It has the early Buzzcocks when they were doing a song called like Boredom. And it
Yeah,
has
yeah.
a lot of that. The 101ers, which was, Joe
Joe
Strummer's
Strummer.
band. Yeah. It has all that stuff on it. And the cover is like a sort of a sarcastic look at the Sgt. Pepper covers, like this distorted sort of view of all these weird punks and stuff, like in the Sgt. Pepper. A lot of that music really reminds me of the stuff that that you seem or you were influenced by people that were influenced by
Yeah,
that.
I feel like that kind of is more of it too, because we were also quite influenced by, Australian bands that were around that time when the Chats were forming, like 5 or 6 years ago. Drunk Mums. For example, like Dumb Punts. Bands like that that were kind of like bringing that sound back in their own way, and we sort of like, we saw bands like kind of doing their thing. We were like, that's cool, like we kind of want to do that. And I think, yeah, we probably brought in, our own influences to that, so I guess that's kind of how it works, isn't it?
That is how it works. That's where I think maybe since we're on the inside, we know. I often don't like these conversations because it reminds me of this movie. What was it called? The Producer, like an old movie with Tim Robbins, I think, in it, where at the beginning of the movie, people are talking about the type of movie they're pushing. It's like a Graduate meets this type of movie thing. So we end up
Right.
sometimes talking about in like making bands sound like they're something else, or something old, or something, combinations. But it's true in many ways. We come from all these influences.
Yeah, whether you realize it or not, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to go back still. Let's go back to the little beginning. So there's a couple of things I was really interested when I was doing some studying on you the last couple of days. The one that I thought was interesting is you went to a St. Teresa's Catholic College. So you meet there, and then you decide to form a band with Matt, and he's been with you from the beginning to now. So as
Yeah. He's been my best mate for like 10 years.
the other thing in there, I would say is I think it said you recorded the first EP in a high school. Was that true? Is it like a system that what is that true, first of all?
It's true. Yeah, it wasn't our school though. It was our mate Finn. He recorded us at the Noosa District State High School, which was maybe like a 20-minute drive down the road. And they had like a proper studio that you could like record in there. Our school didn't really have anything like that. Like they had like guitars and drums and stuff, but they didn't have anything like that. And I think his school was really trying to encourage, kids to learn how to, record stuff and get into that sort of world. So he had like the room for the day, and we would just went in on a weekend for like 4 hours or so and did that first EP.
My darts. I left him in a car. She smoked a whole pack.
Which was a weird one, because I remember we tracked the drums and then the bass and then the guitars, and it was just like a weird feeling to do it like that, And I feel like you can kind of hear it, like it's not like a band in a room playing together.
Right. So that it seems like I think you hooked up with a producer later that encouraged you to record live together more. Was that sort of inspired by your relationship at that recording to want to just do it more live feel in a room?
Yeah, I think it's just like, we were like 16, we were still figuring out how to like kind of be a band, I suppose.
I think what's interesting is that most people like it when you first start out, the budgets are small, so small, and studios are so expensive that you usually do like we did. A lot of the bands, Vindictives, us, even Green Day, all just recorded live, and then eventually we brought on like producers, and then we would record separately. It seemed like you had like an opposite experience where you were in that generation where it was kind of done that way of separating everyone, and it just didn't feel right to what you were doing.
Yeah, I suppose. And I don't think it was like anyone necessarily like pushing it that way. I think it was just, you know, the limits of our resources at that studio, I guess. I don't think they had the equipment to be able to like record altogether.
So you put that out and you're still just in your circuit of playing in each other's basements and stuff. And then what keeps it going? Like, I don't know. I mean, you could be outcast, but it seemed like somehow you were driven. Like whether you liked being in school or not, you found Matt and you got it. It does not anybody makes that next step to actually keep being a band.
Yeah. I mean, look, we had mates who would like, you know, support us and, you know, acted like what they liked what we were doing, but they probably didn't really. But I mean, we had a lot of fun together, you know, it was exciting. And I kind of like always wanted to be in a band, like growing up. I always loved just music and shit. So just seemed like something to do. I always loved like writing songs and then practicing them with my mates and just hanging out. And yeah, like those early days, like it's weird to think about because it was definitely like we just drove to around all these shows, didn't make any money. And it's like, I think back and it's like, yeah, why were we doing that? It's like, just because it was fun. It was like something to do on the weekend. It was better than going to school or going to work and then going to the same pub that you've been at every other day. You know, it's like something different, something new.
I'm going to say this. I'm going to put this out as a theory why, like, maybe a lot of even well-known people have picked up on your music, like Dave Grohl and stuff, and us.
Hey, John in the Future here. I thought I'd like to clarify this point before I go into this diatribe. I had been reading online, and there was an article that talked about the chats with Dave Grohl. So I'm just going to read you just a little section of that so you know what I am talking about. The Chats frontman Eamon Sandwith joined us on Triple M to chat about the upcoming Foo Fighters Australian tour, which the boys will be supporting, handpicked by Dave Grohl himself. Turns out the Chats and Dave Grohl have been friendly for a few years now, after Dave Grohl showed up to an LA show with Arctic Monkeys frontman Alex Turner and Queen of Stone Age frontman Joshua Homme.
We came from punk when it had like sunk back down. There's the Ramones, and then it went back down again. Hardcore surfaced and it got kind of violent. And then it was back to like us just doing it ourselves and realizing that committing to a band wasn't like you weren't going to get a contract and become famous. It was just, you just did it because it was fun and because it was what you wanted to do. And that kind of went away again. Once Green Day hit it big, I noticed while I was on the road that all of a sudden there'd be these young kids with their parents with them buying like these huge trucks and vans, you know, and all this, like when we're like traveling in this little teeny van with our own homemade, you know, loft that we, you know, get shot out of the window if you break too much. And so, but then it led to this where it broke into the mainstream and now it was on more of a decline. And I think maybe once again, I'm theorizing that comes out in your music. Like it's past that point where you actually thought you would do it for a living.
Yeah. Well, that was never like, it never seemed like a possibility. So yeah, that's just what we did it for. Cause it was fun. And you know, it was just like a good time. It was something that we enjoyed doing.
The I think it's on that second EP that has Smoko on it, right?
Yeah. It's the second one.
One of my best friends here in Japan who keeps me sane, he's from Melbourne, and he introduced me to that song a couple of years ago, I think. He's introduced me to a lot of stuff. He's a huge like Midnight Oil fan, and Hoodoo Gurus we both like. I interviewed Dave Faulkner, who used to be in a punk band too.
Cool. The Victims, yeah.
Yeah, you're familiar. Yeah, the Victims. So yeah,
I love him.
He was actually happy to talk because I'm a huge Guru fan, but I was more interested in talking to him about the Victims. And I think he was kind of excited about that. He doesn't get to talk about that as much.
They're kind of back at the moment. I know they're doing gigs again. They got Ray Arn playing bass for them, but yeah, I would love to see him. That's like one of my top Aussie punk bands.
Doesn't mean I need a facelift. Doesn't mean my brain has slipped. Doesn't mean anything. There's more everything on my mind than on any television screen. Oh, we're not dumb. Television addicts. We're not dumb.
Television addicts.
We're not dumb.
Television addicts.
We're not dumb.
Television addicts.
I don't know if you have some insight into this, but one of my frustrations with Australia is they've put out some amazing bands, movies that like travel the whole world, but it's still seen as like an oddity for something to come out of Australia. Does that make sense? Does that seem right?
Yeah, I mean, definitely to Americans and some people in the UK and Europe a bit. Yeah. I feel like it's like, you know, it's kind of like that whole Crocodile Dundee thing.
Yeah. Then he had the, what was that later guy's name that Einstein, what was his name? He did
Yahoo Serious.
Yahoo Serious. Yeah.
Yeah.
We actually put out an album that had like a lot of punk sort of influence songs on it, right? One of those movies did, I think.
The Yahoo Serious movie, Young Einstein, had a soundtrack called Young Einstein, a serious motion picture soundtrack. It had such bands as The Saints and one of my other favorite Australian bands, The Lime Spiders. That came out in 1989.
Anyway, that wasn't my point.
Okay.
You know, actually, one of the side things I'll say to you, Eamon, I like your honesty, and I see in interviews, and sometimes people are worried about interviewing you because you have short answers. You're honest. But it reminds me of when I started befriending Cody from the Lillingtons. He used to get really down because he'd do these interviews and he was give these short answers, and they would like make fun of him or poke, you know, criticize it, and it would depress him. But to me, it was like, he's just being honest. It's like, it, you know, being in a band doesn't mean you're a great interviewee. You know?
I think I worry a bit about like talking out of my ass too much and just saying something that's I'm either gonna regret or it's just like isn't 100% true just because I'm just talking, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's hard, but yeah, I try to keep track of what I'm saying.
Do you think you've gotten better at it since you've had a little bit more exposure, like international exposure? Are you making yourself get better at it?
I don't know, man. I don't know. It's never something that I've like tried to be good at. Mm-hmm. maybe I should try, but I don't know. For me, it's like, you know, it's just one of those things that you have to do.
Yeah. This is something I love doing. So, Eamon, I hope you actually don't feel like you have to do this. You can You can go right now if you want.
I wanted to talk to you because I was a Weasel fan, but I don't know. Usually I'm just like, I've kind of said a lot of stuff.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm right there with you. I think as an artist, I mean, because I've been an artist my whole life, whether in theater or writing or music, and it's damn difficult to talk about it because you're there to do it. You know, you're not there to talk about it. The art should speak for itself. But I think
I also try not to think about the band too much.
Yeah.
Because I feel like those thoughts can consume you a bit and you become what people expect you to become or something.
Yeah, exactly. I actually had a message like that. Let's see if I can find it. I have these, you know, I probably have more notes than the age you are. These pictures. Let me see if I can find it. Use your edits as a selling point. Does that keep you in? I wrote down, can you be packaged? Meaning if PR and management use your attitudes as a selling point, does that keep you in a box of your own making?
I mean, I guess. I wouldn't really say anyone's really doing that to me, though.
No, but let's get at it then. There's all of a sudden your band just doing it for fun with your friends, but then you somehow this Smoko thing hits not just a punk community, but somehow I think people that aren't even punks or aware of punk are like sharing this song.
Yeah.
I mean, that puts you into a completely different market in some ways. Like,
yeah. And it's weird, man. Just kind of expanding on that a bit. We played a festival a couple days ago. That's predominantly like I would say like a mainstream music festival, like a good chunk of the artists, pop artists, rappers, DJs even. And we were kind of like the only, there were other bands, but they were more indie, more kind of poppy than us. We were kind of the only rock and roll band there. So I was kind of nervous and I was like, I feel like they're just going to fucking boo us off stage or whatever. It was, you know, like a big festival, like thousands of people and stuff. But we just get up there and we just play like we usually do, like just hammer out like 18 songs in like 35 minutes or something. And they were just going off. They were loving it. Like kids, like, and all these kids were just like jumping around, going nuts. And I feel like people just love music that's kind of, you know, just got that energy behind it. And they can kind of tell when you want to like be there and when you want to play for them, you know, when they see, you know, someone who's probably relying heavily on backing tracks and just kind of getting through the performance, it's obvious to them. They know that the energy's not there.
That makes sense to me, because I just I thought it was interesting that I just interviewed Dimitri from Off, and both of your bands covered the same song on that Metallica Blacklist.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And he had said the same thing, because he did a tour with Off in Japan, and they were on the bill with a K-pop band, like a mainstream. He said they were a little bit more punky, but he was worried about the same thing, and everyone just loved it. Like I think he comes from the same schooling of you, of like, you're just there to have fun and sell it, you know, just play your heart out. And watching him and Keith on stage is like, you can't deny that energy is just flowing out of them. Like,
they're incredible. Yeah. And that's what I mean. Like, I try not to think too much about the whole band thing, because when you start thinking like, oh, they're not going to like us, like we're so much different than every other band here. And then it's when you just get up there and just do what you're there to do, it's so much better.
I have an ongoing, in my theater company, I brought this up a couple of times, but my friend Kurt, who we both create a lot of theater, we used to perform every week for like 20 years, and you have to write quickly and then get it up on stage, but it's written, it's not improvised. But his thing was always, you know, fuck the audience, I'm just going to give them whatever the hell I want. And I like that attitude, but I always thought that isn't completely true, because I feel that the creative mind does have a little awareness of that relationship, and that you're trying to build something that they're going to like, even though you want to at the same time say, fuck what you want, I'm doing what I want. You know what I'm saying? I think somewhere in your brain, there's that relationship that exists where you do care to some point of what you're putting out.
It's a thin line, definitely, because as much as you can be like, ah, fuck it, like, you know, I don't give a shit. If you do, like when you do a bad show, it's like, oh, that does suck, and I feel bad for the fans or whatever. So
yeah,
I mean, there's definitely like, you got to toe the line in between not really giving a shit, but kind of giving a shit, I guess, like just giving a tiny shit.
Yeah, that reminds me, I'm going to throw some philosophy at you. There's Albert Camus has the myth of Sisyphus, and it's about Sisyphus was the guy that had to forever infinity roll a rock, you know, up a mountain, and then it would roll back down, and he'd have to push it up again. And then Camus says the way that that Sisyphus is happy is because he has a little bit of a smirk on his face, which means a little bit of an irony. Like, you sort of know that what you're doing is pointless, but if you have a little bit of awareness of it, it gives it a little bit more of a genuineness to it.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, that makes sense. I've never heard that before, but that's good.
I want to hit this because it is what made you hit the mainstreams. I think I saw like the YouTube video has like 15 million views now on your page.
Yeah.
For Smoko.
I remember when it was just 15.
And my friend Ben really dug it too. What?
I remember when it was just 15.
Oh, yeah. But you hit my friend Ben, who he likes some punk bands, but he's, like I said, he's a little bit more like Midnight Oil, who we both love too. But that topic actually really just hit an Australian, like, a nerve.
Yeah.
And I think, was the Frenzel Rom reference to it after yours or before? Because they have that reference too. Isn't that their new record or an older? I can't remember.
They do have a record called Smoko at the Pet Food Factory. That came out like probably 5 or 6 years before our song.
So that word has been in the culture for
decades,
quite a while. Ages,
yeah, I remember like being a kid and driving around my stepdad, and he'd be like, "Oh, you know," because he was always like on some sort of job site or whatever, and he was like, "Oh, you know, I just got to pull in and have a smoker." And I remember like being a kid, like, that's such a weird fucking word, like. Yeah, but I don't know, like, I don't quite remember how I thought of the song. I just remember one day the chorus phrase being like stuck in my head for ages, and I went back, walked home, and like picked up a guitar and just kind of wrote it out in like 15 minutes or so. It was like one of those ones where like the lyrics are just like kind of just come to you, I suppose.
No, I've had those songs too. I have a song with my other band, Even in Blackouts, I call If Leaving Were to Be So Easy. I always explain it that it was actually quicker to write the song than to actually play it.
Yeah, exactly.
But there are some nice references in that. But like, I really like the line, what's the exact line, Eamon, about the sitting on the guy sitting on the milk crate, right?
Milk crate throne is the line.
Yeah, milk crate.
Yeah.
That's a nice little line. Yeah. Was that an actual image that you had seen, or it just popped in your head?
I want to say it just popped in my head. I cannot remember. It's hard.
I'm sorry to make you think about your music, Eamon, but
yeah,
it's kind of my job.
That's cool.
But that hits like a viral thing. And then, I mean, that's why some things are viral. It's not a marker of what your band is or what you believe your band to be. You hit something that people that would never even listen to punk or Vasan are into. But you have to deal with the reality that a lot of your other videos are not going to hit that amount. Does that ever like make you tense or nervous? Does it affect anything?
No.
You know, and that's not even an insult. That's just like, I mean, it's the reality.
Yeah. I totally get that. Because I don't know, in some sort of weird way, it's almost relieving. Because when that whole Smoko thing took off, I was freaking out a bit. Because like, I got on a bus once and this dude was like, "Oh, you're like the Smoko guy, right?" This was like real early, and I was like, "What? No, like, I want that song forever." Like, because yeah. I mean, I think it's like a good song, and that it's like a little overplayed now, but I don't regret doing it. I'm thankful for like the attention it got us, but I still don't want that attention ever again. Like, I'm kind of happy existing how we exist now.
I admire what you said, Eamon, because I feel the same way, and I think some people would get caught up in that. All of a sudden people are knocking on your door asking you to do this, and then trying to repeat that is like it's like a Sisyphus task. It's like trying to put that the boulder is the Smoko song, trying to push it up a big mountain, and then it comes back rolling down all the time.
Yeah, I don't know. It was just like, we were never like, all right, like, what do we do now? It was just kind of like, oh, we'll just keep doing what we were already doing.
Well, I think what has happened is that, once again, like I said, I think you triggered enough of old school people like myself and people like in that age, like Off and Dave Grohl, to actually recognize the honesty that you guys had. So that's why I feel okay talking about this absurdity of the viral thing, because I think you guys have proven yourselves that you're the real deal.
Thanks. But yeah, I mean, it was never like, oh, shit, we're like never ever going to be recognized for anything again. It was just kind of like, oh well, you know, that's cool that happened. If everyone stops caring about us like next month, at least that happened, you know.
Eamon, I always wonder this with the younger generations that have become more like, in the day when MTV, even though I like to watch it, punk back then was sort of a rebellion against videos. And you know, when people did finally do them, you either hated them or loved them. But now it's become more part of the culture of music to actually put out videos. Do you have a pretty one-to-one relationship with that? Is that like a bother to do one? Do you enjoy doing videos, or what's your relationship to that?
Yeah, I do. I feel like, you know, sometimes I'll like listen to songs by other bands and I'll just like imagine music video scenarios. And there was a TV show called Rage that was on quite a lot when I was a kid. They'd do like Saturday, I think it was like Saturday mornings and Friday nights or something. And it was just like, it was just music videos. Like, there wasn't anyone being like, oh, and this next video, like, it was just the videos. So you'd sit down and be like, new music video every 3 minutes or so, and there was like so much music that I discovered just as a kid just watching that. And I don't know, I feel like that kind of shaped me a bit more as like a music fan, you know, like, because you hear stuff on the radio and it's just like whatever, because it's always just like top 40 stuff, whereas Rage actually played some pretty out there stuff, which was cool for a kid to be seeing, you know.
Yeah, we talked about that with when I just had my interview with Jason Wally from Frenzel last week, because
I would have seen a lot of Frenzel on Rage as a kid.
Yeah, I mentioned Rage a lot because once again my friend Ben is into that, and his, I don't know if you've heard of this band called Caustic Soda, but it's a friend of his who, they were on Rage back in the day too. And but they also, my friend Ben, his favorite band is Custard, which I didn't know until him, but they also on Rage had that Custard. They had on that, I don't know if it was Rage technically, but that channel would do where a singer or a band would actually feature, they would play all their favorite music for like videos.
Oh yeah, yeah Rage did that sometimes. Yeah,
that's pretty fascinating that those type of bands could be like, MTV even like went into that realm of, if you weren't on a major label, you were, it didn't get on there anymore. But Rage really seemed to have like, it still does from what I'm told, to have sort of an ability to put stuff on there that other people can't.
I think it was because it was kind of part of Triple J, which I'm sure Jay probably got into because he worked there for a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was all part of Triple J, and Triple J were always, at least back in those days, very welcoming and supporting of new young Australian artists.
Hello, John in the future. I'm going to do a little, what I'll call right now, cleaning house. First of all, Triple J is a government-funded national Australian radio station intended to appeal to listeners of alternative music, which began broadcasting in January of 1975. The station also places a greater emphasis on broadcasting Australian content compared to commercial stations. Triple J is a division of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. And also, I'll clarify that I talked to my friend Jeremy, who is in Caustic Soda. They were never on Rage. They were on a show called Recovery, a Saturday morning show on the ABC National Network.
So I think that kind of carried into the Rage thing, which was kind of seems like ages ago now, but it wasn't really that long ago. But yeah, I mean, Rage is still sick.
Yeah, yeah. I always put links to that on there because whenever I see something on there, I'm like, oh, that's really damn cool. I wish I had something like that. You do that video, and that must have garnered some attention to you from like Universal or other labels and stuff. Did you go through that rigmarole of all of a sudden these people are approaching you and then you have to choose what path you want to take?
Sort of. Not really. I mean, no one was really rushing to the chat store. It was kind of like, what is the deal with these guys? Is this even going to be around soon? But I think, you know, when we just kept doing our thing, like did a couple more 7 inches and... Yeah, and then when we were getting around to like kind of do our first record is when we actually started getting like offers for that stuff. None of it really seemed worth it to us, so we always kind of just stuck with our own label, like self-releasing it.
Well, that's why I'm curious about this. Maybe you can explain it to me, because it's on the wiki, which can be wrong because it's, you know.
Yeah.
But it says it's under Universal Music Publishing, but also you have like your own label or subsidiary of that?
Yeah, yeah, Bargain Bin. So it's like the publishing thing. But yeah, I mean, the publishing, that seemed like a better option for us because we could kind of have that support. Like they would, you know, release it and stuff, but we could actually have some cash and we didn't have to like conform to like what they like wanted us to do or whatever.
Who was there someone that you that helped you make that decision? Like I would never. I mean, that's
yeah.
Wise.
We would have been our managers. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. You already had. So did you already have like managers early on, or that once that viral stuff happened?
No, it was like probably a few months after all that viral stuff.
Because it isn't really an instinct of like a like here. I'm just bringing it back to when we were doing it punk for fun. There was no real instinct to get managers. I mean, some bands were, but it was mostly. You just sort of learned how to do everything by yourself. So I guess I'm kind of curious in that move to managerize yourselves.
Well, it got to a point where I couldn't do it.
Ah.
It was literally just too much work. Like you don't want to be playing shows, waking up, getting the van and just start replying to emails all day.
Yeah. So you were getting like a lot of messages.
Yeah. You want to like just show up to the gig and kind of do your show, I guess.
Yeah. I think once again, like we're talking about that reacting to the audience and the fuck it attitude, it seems like that sort of exists in that sort of realm too. Like doing it yourself gets to the point where you're like, here's another weird reference, but Samuel Beckett, who was a playwright, was really obsessive about, he would do all the own translations of his stuff and all, everything. He managed everything of his work, but he started not putting out new material because all of his time was spent doing that business, reading contracts, you know, doing translations. And I think that's kind of like a hard thing for a creative person to make a decision to give that stuff up.
Yeah.
Because in some ways it does affect your product in some ways, like those decisions.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I totally get where you're coming from, but I just knew like I can, as an 18-year-old kid, you're like, I can handle maybe managing a band that has 200 fans, but when this becomes a proper thing, it's just not plausible anymore. It's like, it's just not happening.
Because I come from a perspective with like Screeching Weasel, where we built it over like 8 years and we never had like something that like pushed it. Like by the time Green Day already came out, we were already not Green Day, you know, we were already on our path. So we never had, so we just slowly learned everything. You know, I never had managers. I booked everything until the last 20 years of the band. But I could see how you had this different experience of that. All of a sudden, you went from having to do little outside of the band to everything.
Yeah, we went from just like, you know, sending your mate a text message being like, hey, is there any gigs on this Friday? And he'd be like, yeah, you know, jump on this, to having to do like, you know, writers and run sheets and just all this stuff that you just don't know how to do as a teenager.
Yeah. Was it important to you back then to take advice from people that you respected, or did you just jump at who, you know, like whatever came at you to help out?
I definitely rebuffed a lot of managerial offers. I trusted Alan Weston due to the, you know, whole Cosmic Psychos connection and the fact that I feel like they actually were the only people who like properly listened to us and kind of understood us as a band rather than as like a product.
John of the future for the last time here. It was at this moment that I realized that I had mismanaged my time with Eamon and that we had run out of time before I had finished my questions and he had another appointment to get to. We have made tentative plans to perhaps do a part two sometime in the future. I have quite a few more questions and I'm excited to see what happens to them over this next year. So stay tuned for another episode if we can make it happen. I really enjoyed talking to Eamon, and then we had this nice little goodbye at the end.
Thanks, Jughead.
Bye-bye, Eamon. See you.
See you, dude. Do this.
If you have made it this far, you just got done listening to Struck by Lightning by The Chats off their 2022 record, Get Fucked. Thank you, everybody. That was a pleasure to do, and hopefully a pleasure to listen to. Upcoming, I will continue more with some of these Australian bands. I will have, hopefully, like who we talked about on this show, the Cosmic Psychos. I just finished an interview with Mr. Link from The Meanies. Also un-Australia related, I have an interview with Tane Graves from the band Tightwire. Go to www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com and become a patron, or just search around that site for a little while and then share some shit, like some of my podcasts. Share them on all of your social networks before they disappear or become something sentient. All right, everybody. See you next time.